In our studies in the book of Daniel so far, we've seen events that have already been fulfilled, details that are being fulfilled now, and also things which have yet to happen. Well, most of this talk, this last one for this afternoon, is concerned with things that are yet to happen, future events. And we're going to have a look at the last few verses of Daniel chapter 11, and then have a look at Ezekiel 38 to go with it, God willing. So let's start off then by just reading together Daniel chapter 11, verses 40 to 43. And just try to get into your minds when we're reading this, the detail that we're given here. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. Now, when you look at those verses, quite obviously, we have here described a massive invasion of the Middle East by a power that's described here as being the king of the north. In verse 41, we're told that he will enter into the glorious land. Now that means the land of Israel. It's going to be invaded. But so will other countries also in the region, not just Israel. You'll notice in verse 41 that Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon are said to escape. Now, why are they going to escape when the king of the north sweeps down across the Middle East? Well, we've really got to wait and see. What we can say, though, is that the territory of these three is the present kingdom of Jordan. Now, at the moment, Jordan is very much pro-West, although, during the Gulf War, as you remember, King Hussein's loyalty to the West was seriously in question. So perhaps the end of verse 41 is suggesting that at the time of the end, Jordan will have changed her allegiance. She'll have changed sides. But the king of the north, this is last thing in the afternoon. The king of the north, rather, does more than this, because in verse 42 and 43, he actually sweeps down as far as Egypt, and he takes that country along with her allies, Libya and Ethiopia. But end of verse 45 tells us that it will be in Israel that he chooses to make his headquarters, and there he will meet his end. That's what it says, isn't it? The end of verse 45, yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. Now here we have then a prophecy about the time of the end. But let's be clear, are we really justified in assuming that these are future events? After all, the land of Israel has been invaded many times in the past. Is it really future? Well, this prophecy actually goes on beyond the end of chapter 11. It goes right on through to the early verses of chapter 12. Now, chapter divisions are very useful. We'd find it hard to manage without them. We constantly quote chapter and verse. But as far as we know, the chapter divisions we have in our Bibles were put there by Archbishop Stephen Langton early in the 13th century. They're not part of the inspired text. And sometimes they do tend to obscure links. And when you look at the Bible, it's always best to see if there are any links between the end of one chapter and the beginning of another. Because quite often the chapter divisions are not in the most helpful place. Well, this is a case in point. Because if you have a look at chapter 12 and verse 1, you'll see that it carries on from the end of chapter 11. The end of chapter 11, we have the king of the north in the land of Israel. That's his headquarters, and there he comes to his end. Then verse 1 of chapter 12, and at that time,
when the king of the north comes to his end. What time? Well, verse 40 of chapter 11, it's the time of the end. At that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. And then in verse 2, and many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. So at this time of the end then, Daniel is telling us there's going to be a terrible time of trouble and distress upon the earth, but God's people are going to be delivered. Also, at this same time of the end, the resurrection of the dead is going to take place. That's what it says in verse 2. Well, that tells us immediately that we've got to be looking at future events. Events associated with the coming of Christ and the setting of the kingdom. The time of the end. Well, now come back to verse 40 of chapter 11. We're quite clear then that we're looking at future events. Things that haven't yet happened. Back in chapter 11 and verse 40, we're told that the king of the south and the king of the north are in opposition to each other at the time of the end. But who are these kings of the north and the south? They're actually titles based on details that are given earlier on in the same chapter. Come back, if you will, to the beginning of chapter 11. We need just to look back in history, just for a few minutes, to understand who we're talking about here. So Daniel chapter 11 and verse 2. And some of these details we should be quite familiar with now, really. And now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia, or Greece. So now in chapter 11 then, there's no symbolic language being used, no reference to a ram or a goat, but Daniel is told in the plainest of possible terms about the Persians and the Greeks. Can we have the first overhead on them, please, Michael? I've tried to lay out the basics of Daniel chapter 11 and verse 2 on that overhead. Made it nice and big so you can all read it. We start off then in the reign of Cyrus. Now he is Cyrus the Second, or Cyrus the Great as he's sometimes called, and his dates are put up there, approximate dates anyway. Now this particular prophecy in chapter 11 was given in the third year of the reign of Cyrus. You can check that by looking back at verse 1 of chapter 10. That's when the prophecy was given, the third year of the reign of Cyrus. And here in verse 2, Daniel is being told that three kings after Cyrus were going to follow. Now, the next king after Cyrus was his son, called Cambyses. The one after that, you'll see, is in brackets for a reason. Because this man Cambyses, although he succeeded Cyrus, apparently murdered his brother, who was called Smerdis, and also went mad. Well, it seems that an impostor then set himself up called Gamates, or sometimes he's known as Gautama, or, a lovely name this, Pseudo-Smerdis. In other words, a false Smerdis. Smerdis being Cambyses' own brother, who'd been killed. So here you've got this impostor then, who sets himself up as king, and he reigns for 7 months. Now Cambyses actually set out to put down this particular rebellion, but he died on the way. Hence the 7 month reign of the pseudo-Smerdis. And eventually he was killed at the end of that period by a cousin of Cambyses, Darius Hystaspes, Darius I. Now you mustn't confuse him with Darius the Mede. Two totally separate people. Darius the Mede in the book of Daniel lived at the time of Cyrus himself. This is Darius the Persian. He was the one who killed off this impostor and then became the ruler of Persia. But you see that in verse 2 of chapter 11, after these three, there was going to be a fourth king who is said to have been richer than the others, and he's the one who stirs up all against the realm of Greece. And that was fulfilled in the last one on the bottom there, Xerxes the First. Now, he's probably the Ahasuerus of the Book of Esther, incidentally. These titles like Xerxes and Cyrus and so on, they were titles rather than people's personal names. And some of them may well have had more than one title. So there's Xerxes the First. He was the richer king. And Daniel tells us that this king would stir up all against the realm of Greece. And it was in fact this Xerxes who began the war with Greece, which eventually led to the fall of the Persian Empire. Now, we made the point last night when we were looking at the slides that the Bible never gives you history just to give you a history lesson. It's always making a point. There's always a spiritual lesson behind it. It's always history in relation to the purpose of God. So when you get down to verse 3, we'll see that the text jumps straight on to Alexander the Great, even though there were actually several more Persian rulers after Xerxes. But the Bible isn't interested in them. As far as the Bible is concerned, it was this Xerxes who started the war against Greece, and eventually that led to the rise of Alexander the Great. So come down to verse 3 then. And a mighty king shall stand up, that shall rule with great dominion, and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken, and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others beside those. So verse 2 then ended with this conflict between Persia and Greece. The mighty king in verse 3 is an obvious reference, as we said, to Alexander the Great. He ruled with great dominion. Eventually, though, his kingdom was broken and divided into four. And what's more, the territory didn't go to his posterity, because Alexander died without any children. His power was inherited by men who were not descended from him. They were his generals, but they were not his own descendants. Can we have the second one on, please? This just lays out what actually happened. Put simply, because it needs to be simple for me to follow it anyway, and hopefully you'll be able to. That's Alexander the Great, whose power is broken, and the kingdoms divide into four. There you've got the four generals, Cassander, Lysimachus, Ptolemy and Seleucus, and in brackets underneath I've just laid out basically the areas over which they ruled. A little bit more complicated than that, there are some smaller territories involved, but those are the main areas over which they ruled. Cassander taking Greece, Lysimachus had Asia Minor or Turkey, Ptolemy was down in the south, Egypt and Israel, and Seleucus up in the north with Syria. That's briefly how it worked out. But be careful, because you shouldn't assume, and some people have found a problem with this, that Alexander's empire was immediately divided up into four when he died, because it wasn't. And you may find, if you're looking at this, you become disappointed and you find, well, where are these four rulers? What actually happened was this. For about 20 years after Alexander's death, his generals, and there were more than four of them, fought over the territory. But after the Battle of Ipsus in 301 BC, it settled down to this fourfold division. But it didn't actually end there, because the struggle between these generals went on. And after about another 20 years, these four powers, these four divisions, had actually been reduced to two. The Seleucids up in the north, ruling the Asiatic provinces, and the Ptolemies in the south, ruling Egypt and adjacent territories, including the land of Israel. Now that takes you then to Daniel chapter 11 and verse 5. Now we're not going to go through this, but if you scan your eye from verse 5 down of Daniel chapter 11, you'll see frequent references to the king of the north and the king of the south. Because now the four divisions of the Greek empire had come down to two. The Seleucids up in the north and the Ptolemies down in the south. And these two kings began a long struggle with each other. And the land of Israel suffered enormously during their state of civil war, because Israel was basically sandwiched between the two kingdoms. We could go through the details of the rest of chapter 11. If you're interested in the detail, and it really is fascinating, the book that came out from the Christadelphian office a year or two by Brother Edmund Green goes through chapter 11 verse by verse. Also, Dr. Thomas in Elpis Israel gives you a paraphrase of chapter 11 where he lays out all the history that was fulfilled in minute detail, and this is where David's Antiochus Epiphanes comes in later on in the chapter. But we're going to skip over all of that now because we're really only concerned with the end. But you see where the king of the north and the south comes from. Now, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies have long since departed from the scene. But verse 40 of Daniel chapter 11 is telling us that at the time of the end, this pattern is going to be repeated. The time of the end, there will be another king of the north and another king of the south, and those two will be opposed to each other just as they were in the past. Or to put it another way, at the time of the end, we should expect to see the Middle East divided up into two distinct spheres of influence. One to the north of Israel and one to the south. Now, there are other prophecies which lead us to the same conclusions. We've only got time to look at one now, very briefly, Ezekiel 38. But it's one that we often do look at, so it's perhaps a good one to choose. If you'd like to come back there, this prophecy deals with events that are to take place at the time of the end, or as Ezekiel calls it, the latter days. And we saw this morning that that phrase, latter days, is looking forward to the time of Christ and the kingdom. So it's the same time that we're looking at. Now, whereas Daniel 11 emphasises the wider picture of an invasion of the Middle East, including Israel, Ezekiel 38 focuses in on the invasion of Israel itself. It's a bit more specific in that sense. In verse 15 of that chapter, we read of this invader, "And thou shalt come from thy place out of the north parts." Now, actually, the Hebrew is a bit more specific than that. Another translation, a better one, would be, "Thou shalt come from thy place out of the uttermost parts of the north." This is talking about a power that comes from the extremities of the north. "Thou and many people," that's plural, peoples, nations in other words, "with thee, all of them riding upon horses, a great company and a mighty army." Now, if you're thinking, that sounds a bit strange because we're dealing with the future, can we really expect an army to come down against Israel with all the troops riding on horses? Well, you've got to remember that the language that was given to Ezekiel had to mean something in the day that it was written. But more than that, if you actually pick out of the Old Testament the way in which the horse is used, you find that it's frequently used as a symbol of military power. Now, we can't go back through the passages now, but if you check it up sometime, you'll see that that is right. And so here you've got this military power coming from the uttermost part of the north with many nations, many people with him. And he comes down against Israel. And Ezekiel focuses in here on this northern confederacy, and he does actually tell us more about the nations involved. Just come back to verse 2, and could we have the next overhead on, please, Michael? Verse 2. Now, while we look through verses 2 to 6, we'll just read through them very quickly. You'll see that on the map, okay, we've got it right now, on the map, the places that you're going to read about are marked. And then very briefly, we'll just go through some of the evidence as to why they are placed where they are. Verse 2 then of Ezekiel 38. "Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal." Now just stop on that for a moment. I haven't looked to see what the modern translations say here, but the word chief in the Hebrew is the word rosh. And really, chief prince would be much better translated prince of Rosh, Meshech and Tubal. Now, the details are a bit complicated, but basically, when scholars in Old Testament times translated the Old Testament into Greek, they recognised that this place, Rosh, was a place, and they put it into the text. But when Jerome came much later on to do his Latin translation of the Bible, because he'd never heard of the place called Rosh, he translated it as a common noun, which means chief. And lots of the versions have followed suit. But really it is the prince of Rosh, Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him and say, "Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech and Tubal, and I will turn thee back and put hooks into thy jaws, and will bring thee forth, and all thine army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed with all sorts of armour, even a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords, Persia, Ethiopia and Libya with them, all of them with shield and helmet, Gomer and all his bands, the house of Tagama of the north quarters and all his bands, and many people or peoples with thee. So that's the list of nations then. Now, these nations, first of all, have reference to peoples who Ezekiel would have known about, to powers that existed then. First of all, take Gog, the land of Magog, in verse 2. Now, you'll notice that it's marked on there, if you can pick it out, just up here. Magog, the land of Magog. Now, Ezekiel would have understood that to be speaking of the barbaric Scythian peoples far to the north. As a matter of fact, we know quite a lot about these peoples from Assyrian inscriptions. And from time to time, these barbaric peoples came southwards and attacked the nations of the civilized world. And these Scythians settled in northeastern Europe and Central Asia. Now, the modern territory covered by this would include Germany, now reunified, Poland, and the western part of the Soviet Union. The leader of this northern host is said to be the Prince of Rosh, and there's pretty good evidence that Rosh is an ancient name of Russia. It is known to be such. And similarly, Meshech and Tubal can also be identified with the regions of Moscow and Tobolsk, and they're marked also on the map. Persia, well, that's modern Iran, isn't it, that he mentions in verse 5. Ethiopia and Libya in North Africa, they're names that we readily recognise still. They're going to be in league with the King of the North at the time of the end. Then down in verse 6, you've got Gomer and Tagama and all their bands or all their hordes. Now, first of all, Gomer. Well, the descendants of Gomer settled initially to the north of the Black Sea, which is marked there in about the middle of the map, but they were pushed down then south into Asia Minor, or modern Turkey, which is where they're actually marked, Gomer's marked there, by other Scythian tribes. Josephus, in his history, identifies Gomer with the Galatians, or the Gauls, who migrated west to France. So it seems that the bulk of the people belonging to Gomer settled there in Asia Minor, but they were also pushed westwards and gave rise to the Gauls over there in France. The descendants of Tagama, and I don't think they are marked on there, but it's thought that they settled in Armenia, which is the southern part of the Soviet Union. So, to sum it up then, Gomer, Tagama, and all their hordes include Turkey, Armenia, the southern Soviet Union, therefore, and some at least of the Western European nations, possibly including France. We can't be too dogmatic, really. It seems then, from all of this, even if we can't be exact on every detail, but it does seem, when you put it all together, that much of Europe will be on the side of Gog, the King of the North, at the time of the end. Now, a few years ago, this would have seemed a very remote possibility indeed. But now, with the old east-west divisions having been broken down, it's a situation that could easily develop in the near future. Ezekiel tells us something else as well. If you come over to verse 13, he says that there's going to be a group of nations who protest. Now, if they protest, it means that they're not part of this Gogian confederacy, taking up a large part of Europe. This alliance of nations, therefore, corresponds to Daniel's King of the South, an alliance that protests. So it's verse 13 of chapter 38. Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish, with all the young lions thereof, shall say unto thee, Art thou come to take a spoil? Hast thou gathered thy company to take a prey, to carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, to take a great spoil? Now, Sheba and Dedan are quite easy to identify, both from the Bible and from sources outside the Bible. They can be identified, as they're marked on there, with the nations of the Arabian Peninsula. That is to say, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. Today, just as in the past, they represent states of great wealth. Now, of course, their wealth is based largely upon oil. And they're in alliance with these merchants of Tarshish. Now, this is a difficult one, often been argued about. What do we understand by the merchants of Tarshish? Well, on that particular map, you'll see that Tarshish is labelled right next to Britain. Perhaps, though, it's a little bit more complicated than that. This really comes by way of a suggestion. What does the Bible tell us about Tarshish? Well, here's a quick run-through. First of all, in the book of Genesis chapter 10, Tarshish is said to inhabit the isles of the Gentiles. Jonah, in the book of Jonah, boarded a ship at Joppa, which is the eastern end of the Mediterranean, to go to Tarshish. Now that implies that he was going westwards as he boarded the ship from Joppa, especially since Isaiah 23 describes Tarshish as being afar off in relation to Israel. It was a long way away. Now, if it was a long way away from Israel and Jonah got on a ship at Joppa, it implies that he was going way out west somewhere. Ezekiel 27 tells us that Tarshish traded with Tyre. Now, Tyre was the ancient capital of the Phoenicians, who were great sailors and traders of the ancient world. They traded with Tarshish. In the same chapter, Ezekiel 27, you can look it up at some point if you like, we're told what they got from Tarshish, and it was this: silver, iron, tin, and lead. So from these passages then, Tarshish was a far-off land in the west where these particular metals were found. Now in the second book of Chronicles, chapter 9, we're told that Solomon and Hiram, king of Tyre, had a navy at Ezion-Geber in the Gulf of Aqaba. In other words, it was just about at this point there. They kept a navy just about there, on the right-hand fork of the Red Sea there. And we're told that the ships of this navy went to Tarshish. And it was a long voyage. It took a 3-year voyage, it says, for these ships to go. And they returned with gold, silver, ivory, apes and peacocks. Well now, if Tarshish was located in the west, then that navy on its 3-year voyage could have got there by finding its way around the African continent and up the West African coast, where many of these items could have been obtained. We know as a fact that the Phoenicians did reach the West African coast. They also reached Spain, Britain, and even further afield. What we're suggesting then is this, that Tarshish was the extreme western world known to these ancient trading nations. And in more recent times, the power of Britain and latterly the United States seems to have emerged quite convincingly to fill the role of the biblical Tarshish. And this view is strengthened when you consider that both Britain and the United States have become increasingly involved with the development of Saudi Arabia, a country which has strong links with the capitalist West. The Gulf crisis has only served to enhance that growing relationship. So we might actually be seeing now, developing before our very eyes, an alliance which, when the time is right, will lead Sheba, Dedan, the merchants of Tarshish, and Daniel 11 implies that Egypt also will be involved with them, saying to the king of the north, "Art thou come to take a spoil?" But they can't do anything to stop him. That's the point that the chapter is making to us. It's only God who can stop the king of the north. Verse 21 then of this chapter. "And I will call for a sword against him throughout all my mountains, saith the Lord God. Every man's sword shall be against his brother." The enemies of Israel will actually start killing each other. Well, that's the way God works. "And I will plead against him." Now, that word plead really means judge. It's an old sense of the word. "I will judge him with pestilence and with blood, and will rain upon him and upon his bands and upon the many people that are with him, an overflowing rain and great hailstones, fire and brimstone." And so Gog and all his allies are completely destroyed by the power of God. Well, come back to Daniel chapter 11, because our time has gone. Just to sum up very briefly, we're suggesting then that Ezekiel 38 and Daniel chapter 11 are both speaking about this great crisis to come. They both tell us about an invasion of the Middle East by a northern power. Both prophets tell us that this power will descend upon Israel. Daniel describes his coming as being like a whirlwind. Ezekiel, on the other hand, says it will be like a storm, like a cloud to cover the land. Both prophets speak about Ethiopia and Libya as being his allies. And in both accounts, we're assured that this northern power will be miraculously destroyed. This, then, is the picture that's given to us by the prophets of a time of trouble such as never was. But for the faithful in Christ, there's no need for us to be fearful at all. Quite the opposite, in fact. Because when you get down to verse 3 of Daniel chapter 12, we're told in verse 2, first of all, that this time we'll see the resurrection of the dead, and those who are accepted by Christ at that time, we're told in verse 3, will shine as the brightness of the firmament. Or as Jesus put it in one of his parables, then shall the righteous shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Daniel's going to be there shining forth at that time. We're told that in the very last verse of the book. He's going to be there. God grant that we too might be able to stand with him at the end of the days.